Well, I hope that everyone has enjoyed their weekend, and let's just wanted to take a moment and thank our hosts for having us here, and Jim and all of his family and the people on Passion for Truth and everybody affiliated with it. I want to say thank you for hosting something like this. I know that this has been a big job. Now, I want you to turn with me to John chapter 11. And some of the things that I'm going to be sharing this morning, I know that for many of you, it's not going to be anything new per se. But I want to cover some principles, if I can call them that. And my reason for doing that is pointing out the obvious is going to be to point out some things that aren't quite so obvious. But in John chapter 11, and I better get my eyes on. But in John chapter 11, beginning verse 45, this is just after Yeshua has raised Eleazar, or Lazarus, from the dead. And then it says, "And then many of the Jews who had come to Mary and who had seen the things Yeshua did believed in him. But some of them went away to the Pharisees and told him the things Yeshua did. And then the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered a council and said, 'What shall we do? For this man works many signs. If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation,'" that is, the nation of the Jews. "And one of them, Caiaphas, being high priest that year, said to them, 'You know nothing at all, nor do you consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and not that the whole nation should perish.' Now, this he did not say on his own authority, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Yeshua would die for the nation." And again, that is, I believe, referring to the nation of the Jews. "And not for that nation only, but that he should also gather together in one the children of God who were scattered abroad." And so, put very simply, in John chapter 11, we have scripture here that tells us that Yeshua, in his death, and then the subsequent burial and resurrection, all of that was to accomplish one goal. That he did this on behalf, if I can put it this way, of two distinct categories of people. And yet, even though they are two distinct categories, that is, the Jews and the children of God who were scattered abroad, the goal was to make them one. And so now, I'm not ethnically Jewish, as far as I know, and so I'm going to assume that a lot of you would fall into the same category as I, and of these two, that would be the category that is described as the people of God who were scattered abroad. And so, this passage is suggesting very strongly that the Messiah's death, burial, and resurrection was so that these two could become one. And we know that we have a host of other scriptures, Romans chapter 11, Ephesians 2, where Paul discusses this whole concept of making the two one in Ephesians 2. In fact, just to paraphrase, starting around verse 11, he writes to them and says, "Now remember that you once being Gentiles," well, stop. If I was once a Gentile, what am I now? And he goes on to talk about how that you once being Gentiles and you were cut off from the covenants of promise. You weren't part of the commonwealth of Israel. And to put it plainly, you guys were toast. But because of the Messiah, he's broken down this middle wall of partition and he's making the two one. And so now you are no longer foreigners and strangers, but are fellow citizens and members of the household of God. And so if we weren't part of the commonwealth of Israel, if we were cut off at one point in time because of the Messiah, he is making the two one. And so that's the principle. So that's what's obvious, that he has come to make the two one. Going all the way back to the beginning, because everybody understands that everything pretty much is established in the beginning. And so in the beginning, the Creator forms a body from the dust of the earth. And then he breathes the breath of life into that man. And then he became a living nephesh. He became a living soul. And then he makes the observation, after doing this, it's not good for man to be alone. And so I'm going to make him a helpmate. Literally, ezer kenegdo. More literally, a help opposite. A helper who is going to oppose him. And all the men are thinking, oh, now I get it. But that is literally what it's saying. A helper who is his opposite. And the idea, as I understand it anyway, is her opposition is not to undermine his authority. Her opposition is suggesting that there are times that he needs help. And we know this is true because the Creator says of man, it is not good that man is alone. And I can tell you, it is not good for man to be alone. It's really not good. Because man left to his own devices is self-destructive. Because men, we like to build things, admire them, and then blow them up. It's true. Because when we were kids, we would go to the craft store and we'd buy our model airplanes and model tanks and model ships, and we'd get all our paraphernalia together and we'd go sequester ourselves in our room and we'd put these things together. We'd put them on our bedroom shelf, admire them for about 6 weeks, get bored, take them out in the backyard, stuff them full of firecrackers, and blow them up. Am I right, gentlemen? And guess what? We still do that today. We build tall buildings. We admire them for about 25, 30 years, stuff them full of dynamite, and blow them up. And why? So we can build another building, of course. It's not good for man to be alone. Because the women wouldn't blow the building up. They would just refurbish it. They would get new curtains and they would do all those kinds of things. So the implication is there are times that the man is going to get off the path. And so the Creator, in his wisdom, saw fit to give him a help opposite. Someone is going to help him by seemingly opposing him, but not, again, to undermine his authority, but to help him to become the man that God created him to be. So, thank God for the ladies. Right, gentlemen? Right? If your wife's watching, you better clap. But here's the picture we want to see. He created this body. He formed this body from the dust of the earth. He breathed into him the breath of life, and then he became a living nephesh. But then he makes the observation that he should not be alone. I'm going to make him this help opposite. And then, interestingly, he parades all the animals before Adam. But there was not found that mate that he needed there. And so what did he do? He caused him to fall into a deep slumber. He caused him to fall into this unconscious state. And while the, if I can put it this way, the original body is in this unconscious state, that's when he went to him and he apparently opened up his side and removed part of his side. And I say opened it up because it says later that he closed up the flesh thereof, which would mean then if he had to close it up, then he obviously had to open it up. But he took that rib or that side from the man, and from that he made a woman. Because the record does not tell us that he then took dust from the ground as he did with the original, but from that side he made this other body. And this other body looks a little different, but not totally different. This other body, well, she speaks a little differently, a little softer most of the time. But she doesn't speak a foreign language, if you will. And this other body has a different perspective of things. But that's not to say that she's wrong and he's right, or vice versa. It's just to say that she sees things from a different perspective than he sees them. In other words, the Creator put things within each of them that the other needed. His strengths would complement her weaknesses. Her strengths would complement his weaknesses. And although they could have gone, if you will, their separate ways and functioned to some degree on their own, that's not what the Creator had in mind. The way he designed it was so that these two, with all the qualities that they possessed, when they come together, then they could be fruitful and multiply. not apart from one another. Then he presents this other body to the man. And he says, bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. And for this cause, Moses says, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and the two shall become levesar echad, unto one flesh. And what's interesting about the statement that Adam makes is, bone of my bone, etzam, bone, is related to the word etz, which means tree. In fact, the whole idea in Hebrew anyway of bones is related to the tree, because, I mean, you think of our skeletal structure. We have, we have trunk, we have limbs, just like a tree does. And so, inferred in the text, when he says bone of my bones, is something like tree of my tree. Or that tree can actually come out of this tree. Or that tree's part of this tree. And flesh of my flesh, basar, the word for flesh, is the root of besorah, which means good news, or gospel, or the message. In other words, she's part of me. And her tree is part of my tree, and her branch is part of my branch, and her message is actually something that come out of me. And so what I'm wanting you to see is, there was a body that was incomplete, if you will, if I can put it that way, that fell headlong into an unconscious state. And while he was in this unconscious state, the Creator took from him a portion and made another body that looked a little different, spoke a little differently, had a slightly different perspective on things, and yet was part of this body. And so we have the picture in the beginning that the Creator brings them both together as one and says, these are to be one flesh, and then be fruitful and multiply. So can you imagine a prophetic scenario where we have a body over here that goes into an unconscious state, and in that unconscious state there's a portion of that body that's removed, and then from that comes this other body that looks different, acts different, speaks differently, and yet not totally. And then the Creator is wanting to bring those two together and make them one. Are any of y'all tracking with me this morning? Four of you are. Good. All right. So that's why Yeshua, according to John chapter 11, that's what his mission was. That's what his goal was. That they would be one. Father, I pray that you would make them one even as you and I are one. And so then, that's the obvious. That's why Yeshua came, to make them one. And so if that was Yeshua's goal, if that's his objective, if that's the Father's purpose from the beginning, then we automatically know what the adversary's objective is. You understand? If the Father's purpose is that the two should become one, then by default we understand what the adversary's objective is going to be. Is to keep them from being one. He's going to try to continue to keep them divided and to keep them apart. And everything that is within his arsenal is, I believe anyway, going to be directed at trying to stir up strife and division and misunderstanding and envies and all these different things that break relationship. I mean, consider that the adversary, he wasn't speaking to the man. He was speaking to the other body. He engaged her in conversation. I need to hold that thought. Let's go to Matthew 17. Matthew 17. And I won't read it for the sake of time, but it should be very familiar to everybody. But it's when Yeshua takes Peter, James, and John up to a high mountain, and he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothing was as white as the light, and standing there with him was Moses and Elijah. Now, when Peter sees this, Peter obviously has the gift of gab, and he just broke out, hey, yeah, it's great that we should be here. Let's do this. Let's build. And all of a sudden, this cloud overshadows him, and a voice comes out of this cloud, and in Bill's translation says, Peter, shut up. This is my son in whom I'm well pleased. Hear him. And of course, the narrative tells us they fall down on their face. They're afraid, as I would have been. I would have been freaking. And so it's kind of comical to me that when they're falling on the ground, Yeshua comes over and touches them and says, hey, don't be afraid. Yeah, right. But they're coming down the mountain and they ask him a question. Now think of all the questions they could have asked. Like, where's Elijah been hanging out all this time? Hey, that was Moses. So just where did you bury him? Just different things. But here's the question they ask. Why do the scribes say that Elijah must first come? And Yeshua says, Elijah will indeed come first and will restore all things. And he goes on to explain that Elijah did come. You just didn't recognize him because he came in the person of John the Baptist. And we don't have time to get into all those things. But here's my point. Of the two, Moses and Elijah, it is Elijah that Yeshua singles out and says, he will come first and will restore all things. Now Moses and Elijah are there with the Messiah on the top of that mountain, not only speaking to him as the text tells us, but I'll suggest to you, their presence is speaking about him. And what does their presence there say? That the Torah, Moses, and the prophets, Elijah, both are testifying that Yeshua is the Messiah and the Son of the living God. Just so you'll know where I stand. So Moses representing the Torah, Elijah representing the prophets, are the two witnesses. Now, I probably shouldn't get into this. I will. Anyway. I have a friend, and I've known him for 20 some odd years, and he's somewhat well known in some circles. You know, he's on television and all these kinds of things. And any time that he wants to discuss the two witnesses and who they are, he makes it a point of bringing out that this is one of the things that me and Bill Cloud disagree with. Because he's of the opinion that it's Enoch and Elijah. And I've discussed with him that I believe it's a Moses and an Elijah. Now, you know, I probably shouldn't tell you who this guy is, Perry Stone. But anyway, one of those things that we don't see eye to eye on, among others. But anyway, I believe it's a Moses and Elijah. But here's why I'm saying that. Because the Torah and the prophets are the two witnesses, and Yeshua validates this for us, because Yeshua himself uses the Torah and the prophets to validate and to verify who he is. But if Moses represents the Torah, I want to also suggest to you that he represents truth. Because according to the psalmist, your Torah is truth. But we understand that the day is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers must worship the Father in spirit and in truth. And where does this conversation take place? John chapter 4. The Messiah and his disciples are traveling through Samaria, and they come to a place called Sychar, better known as Shechem. And the disciples go into town to buy some food. Well, you know the story. Yeshua is there by the well, and here comes this Samaritan woman, which I think most of you understand that the Samaritans were looked upon by the Jews as, well, undesirable, and at best, half-breeds. And so the two avoided one another. And so when this Jewish rabbi asks this Samaritan woman for some water, she's kind of taken aback and says, you know, you're a Jew. Why are you asking me for water? And he says, well, if you knew who was asking, you would ask me for some water. And so the conversation turns to the Messiah and the coming of the Messiah. But here's a couple of things I want to point out. This woman, representative of her people, refers to Jacob as being our father. And so even though the Jews looked down upon them as being half-breeds, nevertheless, they consider themselves to be part of the family, and she refers again to Jacob as our father. And then they start talking about the fact that, well, our fathers have worshipped on this mountain, and you Jews say to worship on that mountain, and when the Messiah comes, I'm hoping he's going to clear all this up. And what mountain was she referring to, by the way? Because this was taking place in a place, again, called Sychar or Shechem, in a plot of ground that had been given to Joseph and his sons. As a matter of fact, not too far away from this particular well, there was a tomb. And in that tomb was buried the bones of a guy by the name of Yosef. Because you'll remember that before he passed away, he said that the Lord will surely visit you, and he's going to lead you up out of this land, and when you go, do not leave my bones here in Egypt. And so when they ate the Passover, what's one of the first things they did? They went to Sukkot, and they got the bones of Yosef, and they were in a box, an Aron, and so Yosef left Egypt with them, or Yosef's bones left Egypt with him. Yosef's bones walked through the Red Sea with them. Yosef went to the mountain with them. His bones heard the voice of the living God. And Yosef's bones crossed the Jordan, the Jordan, with them, and was buried in this valley between these two shoulders, these two mountains. And the one to the north was called Ebal, the Mount of Cursing. The one to the south, Gerizim, the Mount of Blessing. And it's interesting because Gerizim means cuttings. C-U-T-T-I-N-G-S. Cuttings. And the idea behind this is something that has been cut out of another body. I don't know, a plant, a tree. Let's see, maybe an olive tree. And you go over to this olive tree and you cut a branch out of it. You have a cutting from it. That's the idea behind Gerizim. And it's Gerizim upon which these Samaritans are worshiping. So to put the picture together, they're worshiping on a mountain that is named after a concept of something that is separated from the original body. And this conversation is taking place in a valley between these two mountains, in a plot of ground given to Yosef and his sons, and nearby there are the bones of Yosef. And so this is the backdrop of this conversation. So our fathers worship on this mountain, and you Jews worship down there in Jerusalem, and one day the Messiah is going to come and settle all this. And so here's what Yeshua says to the woman. And I'm going to paraphrase. We Jews know what we're doing. You people don't have a clue. Essentially, that's what he's saying. But the day is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers are going to worship the Father in spirit and in truth. May I suggest this to you? In essence, what he was saying is, the Jews have the truth. We know what we're doing. You people, you're doing everything technically wrong. And yet by his statement that the true worshipers must worship the Father in spirit and truth suggests to me that even though the Jews have the truth, he's saying that you people have something too. Maybe you're doing everything technically wrong, but yet there is this something within you, might I say spirit, that compels you to want to worship the one and only God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And in a manner of speaking, he seems to be saying, and so now here's what the Father is looking for. If we can take the truth that they have and then couple it with the spirit that you possess and make those two one, that's what the Father is truly looking for. In other words, they have something this body needs, and you have something that that body needs, and so the two becomes one. That's what the Father's looking for. You following me here? And it's interesting that, you know, when she hears all of this, she runs into town, and most of the town comes out to meet Yeshua. He goes into town with them, and he stays with them 2 days. These are some of the first people to recognize Yeshua as being the Messiah. He stayed with them 2 days. You know, a day with the Lord is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is as 1 day. What I'm trying to suggest to you, well, can you picture a scenario where you've got a body over here that looks at those people as being a bunch of knuckleheads that don't know what they're doing. And you got a group of people over here that look at them and is like, why do they not like us so much? And then the Messiah comes on the scene and says, here's what we're going to do. We're going to make the two one. Can you imagine anything like that? Can you picture something like that? All right. Now, the point in all that was to bring it to this point. We're talking about Matthew 17 again. Moses and Elijah's on top of the mountain with Yeshua. Moses representing the Torah. Elijah representing the prophets. Your Torah is truth, so Moses represents the truth. And so if he represents the truth, I'll suggest then that Elijah represents spirit. But then there's one other thing that I want you to consider, and that is that while we know Moses' genealogy, who his mother and father were, who what tribe he came from, it came from the tribe of Levi, of course. When it comes to Eliyahu, we have no such information. All we know is it says, Eliyahu HaTishbi Mitoshavi Gilead, Elijah the Tishbite, and of the inhabitants of Gilead. And I've shared this many, many times, and I know that a lot of you have already heard me share this, but maybe there are a few that have not, and so for that reason, I want to cover this. You know, I always used to think, and I believe that a lot of other people believed as well, that when it says that Eliyahu or Elijah was a Tishbite, that we supposed that that meant he was from some town or village called Tishbe. In fact, I have a Bible that in the back of it, there's a map of the different areas in Gilead. Within Gilead, it has T-I-S-H-B-E question mark, as if to say, we think maybe Tishbe was around here. But the reality is, if I could show you the Hebrew text from 1 Kings 17, verse 1, what you would see is Eliyahu HaTishbe. Hey, Tav, Shin, Bet, Yud, HaTishbe, the Tishbite. And the next phrase would be Mitoshave, spelled Mem, Tav, Shin, Bet, Yud. In other words, HaTishbe in Mitoshave, if I remove the definite article from the first word, the He, and remove the Mem prefix from the second word, the Mem, the words would be identical. They would be Tav, Shin, Bet, Yud. Tishbe, Toshave. And I challenge you to go home tonight, or to go to your room and look in your concordance for 1 Kings 17:1, the word inhabitants. And you will see that the word that is translated inhabitants in most of our scriptures literally means resident alien, foreigner, stranger. In other words, Eliyahu was of a group of people who were resident aliens who had joined themselves to the people of Gilead. In other words, Elijah, it seems, there's a very strong indication that Elijah was not born ethnically Israeli, but that he come from among the nations. And him, as well as a lot of other people, had joined themselves to the people of Israel. Like Ruth did when she said to Naomi, wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Wherever your people are going to be my people. And more importantly, your God shall be my God. And so what I'm suggesting to you folks is that on top of that mountain, in Matthew 17, with the Messiah, not only speaking to him, but suggesting something about him, is the Torah and the prophets, truth and spirit, the natural branch and the wild branch. And oh, by the way, Gilead was a descendant of Yosef. But of those two, who is it Yeshua singles out as being the one that shall come first and restore all things? It's Elijah. So here's the point. If Elijah does, in fact, represent those who are of this branch that was wild, that was grafted into this good olive tree, contrary to nature, as Paul tells us in Romans 11, if it does represent that group of people who have joined themselves to Israel, and because of the Messiah, because of his blood, they have become part of this family, then who is it in the latter days that has the greatest responsibility to get their act together? Look around the room. And what was it Elijah was to do? It was to restore all things. Because when you think back to when Elijah encounters all of Israel on Mount Carmel in 1 Kings 18, He gathers all of Israel. Ahab is there, and all the prophets of Baal are there, and they do their thing, and finally they sit down and step aside, and Eliyahu comes up. And you remember the first thing he did was to rebuild, or shall we say, restore the altar of God, which had been broken down. And do you remember how he did it? He took stones, not bricks. He took stones and he repaired or restored the altar of God, which was broken down. And how many stones did he use? 12, according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And so the picture then is, when Eliyahu comes on the scene, there are these stones that are scattered around the field, around the mountain. They're scattered about. And so what is he going to do? He's going to begin to gather them and put them back in their proper place. And that has to happen before any fire can fall down. So you remember back in John 11, Yeshua didn't die for that nation only. But why? But that he would gather together in one the people of God who were scattered abroad. And yet, who does Yeshua say is going to play a very, very critical role in this restorative process? It's Elijah. And maybe, just maybe, because we see precedent for this in the scripture in John the Baptist, who was not Elijah, and yet who was Elijah, according to Matthew 11. Maybe, ladies and gentlemen, when Elijah comes this next time, he might not look like everybody's expecting him to look. But when he does come, what is his mission? What is his goal? To start putting those stones back in their proper place. Why? So that the revival can come. So that, if you will, the fire can fall. But until those stones are where they're supposed to be. In other words, until all those scattered stones are becoming one, there are certain things that can't happen. So then on the mountain, once again, it is Elijah that he singles out. And so if Elijah not only represents the prophets and perhaps the spirit, but the wild branch. When our Jewish brethren, those who believe, when they sit down at the Pesach Seder and they set that empty place at the end of the table, and it's that certain point in the Seder when they send the children to the door to open up the doors and start looking for Elijah. And then they begin to sing, Eliyahu ha-Navi, Eliyahu ha-Tishbi, Eliyahu, Eliyahu, Eliyahu ha-Giladi. And they start singing this song that is saying, if you will, we're looking for Elijah. And God, we want you to send him speedily in our days. For we know that when Elijah shows up, Mashiach is not far behind. And so if they're out there looking for Elijah to come and to sit down at the Passover table with them, who are they really looking for? All this is to say, folks, or let me rephrase that. This is not to say that we need to pat one another on our back and say, oh, aren't we special? No, ladies and gentlemen, this is to say that we have a great responsibility in our Father's purposes for these end days. And He is wanting to make us one. He is wanting the two to become one. That is why Yeshua died and was subsequently resurrected. That He didn't do it just for that nation, but that He would gather together in one all the people of God who were scattered abroad. That was the goal. And He wants to use you and me in these days to accomplish or to help accomplish this. Because He always works through people. Right? From the beginning, He's worked through people. When He planted that garden eastward in Eden, who did He put there to tend and to guard it? The man. Now, I don't know why He decided to work through people, but He did. And so that hasn't changed. And so He wants to work through you and me in these days. And so all of that was to say and bring us to this point. If His purpose is that we be one again, what's the adversary's purpose? To bring division? To to bring strife, to keep that from happening. Now, in Zechariah chapter 4, we were talking about this a little bit last night. The prophet sees this menorah, the seven-branch lampstand. And on either side of that seven-branch lampstand are these two olive branches full of olives. And last night, I believe I said this, but last night I suggested to you that one of those branches represents, I believe, the natural branch. And one of those branches represents the wild branch. If you will, going back to Matthew 17, one of them represents Moses and one of them represents Elijah. One of them represents the truth, the spirit, the natural branch, the wild branch. But who's making them one, if you will? It is the menorah. And what does that menorah represent? It represents Yeshua, because he's the light of the world. I want to share a legend, a tradition with you in regard to the Urim Betumim. You've heard of the, right? You're familiar with the Urim and the Thummim. Okay, you know what I'm talking about now. All right. Have you ever noticed when somebody wants to sound ignorant, they adopt a southern accent? You ever notice that? I'm from the South, I can say that. But this is a tradition concerning the Urim and the Thummim, which we know that at times the priest would go to inquire of the Lord about the Urim and Thummim. And there's a tradition that says, well, first of all, we know that it had something to do with the breastplate that the high priest wore. And what was on that breastplate? Stones. How many stones? 12, according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And so it had something to do with the breastplate. And because the word Urim means lights, L-I-G-H-T-S, Tumim means perfection or completion in a plural sense of the word. Urim v'Tumim is the perfect lights, if you will. So it had something to do with light, and it had something to do with the breastplate that the high priest wore, where the 12 stones were. And so what's the only thing in the tabernacle or in the temple that had anything to do with light, as far as we know? The menorah. And so there is a belief that the Urim v'Tumim is some kind of interaction between the menorah and the breastplate and the stones on the breastplate. Now, a tradition is that when Moshe goes to Aholiab and Bezalel and has them fashion the menorah, that he had them to affix the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet on the seven branches of the menorah. Now, if you divide 7 into 22, that's every branch gets 3 letters, and there's going to be one branch that gets an extra letter. We don't have time to go into all of this, but the branch that got the extra letter was that middle branch. Remember the Shemash, the servant branch, which is also the Shemesh, the sun, and those extra letters would have been Yud Chaf Lamed Mem. And in Hebrew, Yichalem, Yud Chaf Lamed Mem means, loosely translated, he will make them whole. If I can put it this way, he will unite them. He will make them complete. Where was Yeshua standing when he spoke to John? In the midst of the 7 golden candlesticks. And why did Yeshua come? He didn't die just for that nation, but that he would gather together in one the people of God who were scattered abroad. And so it's kind of interesting to me that those 4 letters there would be Yechalem. Read in reverse, Malchi, my king. Because there's coming a day when there's just going to be one flock and one shepherd, right? There's coming a day when there's going to be one king and his name shall be Echad. His name is one. So all the typology is here. But the tradition is that concerning the Urim v'Tumim, that when the priest bearing the 12 stones representing the 12 tribes of Israel would go in to inquire of the Lord, that he would stand before the menorah. He would set his face toward the menorah, and that he would inquire of the Lord, and that the lights of the menorah burning would then reflect off of the stones that on the breastplate, and the reflection of the light off of those stones would then begin to cause certain letters on the 7 branches to light up, and that's how the priest would get his answer. Kind of cool, I thought, actually. But here's the point. the light of the menorah reflecting off the face of those 12 stones. And then that reflection causing those letters to light up. Who do those 12 stones represent, ladies and gentlemen? And so what are we supposed to be doing? Remember last night? What does the moon do? Does it generate its own light? No, as it sets its face toward the sun, it begins to reflect the light of the sun. And when do people notice it the most? When it's dark. And when do you think people are going to need answers the most? It's getting dark. So, by the way, Urim begins with the letter Aleph. Tumim begins with the letter Tav. The Aleph and the Tav. So, the point would be then this. If you, I, we need to inquire of the Lord, do you know how we do it? We've got to set our face toward the sun. And as His light reflects off of our face, and then I look in this book, you know what I think is going to happen? The letters are going to begin to light up. The pages are going to begin to light up. Things that we never saw before, we're going to begin to understand. And that's why, I don't have time to get into this, but that's why when we're in our pursuit of Moses and trying to understand the Torah, do not forget the one who causes the pages to light up. Because he's the one Moses wrote us about. Okay, anyway. But what would have happened? Now we know that this couldn't have happened, but what would have happened if Israel needed to inquire of the Lord and the priest goes in to inquire of the Lord, but there's some stones missing? What if those stones weren't in their proper place? And so he goes to inquire of the Lord, and all the stones are not where they're supposed to be, and so the light is reflecting. What would happen, do you think? The message would be incomplete. We'd get a partial revelation, if I can put it that way, but we wouldn't get the whole revelation because all the stones are not in their proper place. They're still scattered about. So what has to happen? All of those stones have to be restored to their proper place. And of the two guys on the top of the mountain, which of the two does Yeshua say is going to play such a crucial role in the restoration of all things? It's Elijah. And I'm recommending to you, ladies and gentlemen, that the onus is not really on what this group of people necessarily to get their act together, even though they have a responsibility to. It's really on you and me. And so the adversary, who is not all-knowing, but he's not all-stupid either. If he understands that Messiah wants to make us one, what do you think he might be trying to do? Divide. And I think, so far, he's doing a pretty good job. And you know who his best accomplices and helpers are? You and me. It was not the Father's purpose that those two in the beginning, the man and the woman, should stay apart. Yeah, they could have functioned to some degree separate, but they could have never been fruitful and multiplied until they'd come together as one. And so the same is true in what we're talking about today. There has been some degree of functioning, you know, with these two distant, if you will, and separate. But there's not going to really be that fruitfulness until the two become one. And so likewise, in this movement or this awakening, and whatever we want to call ourselves, there's been some degree of functioning. But have you noticed there's been a lot of division and strife lately? Three of you have? Okay, well, I guess I'm not really certain what time I'm supposed to be done, so because I don't know what time I started, but somebody let me know something here. Let's go quickly to 1 Corinthians chapter 3. And I'll kind of start to bring it to a close with this. In 1 Kings 3, verse 1, "And I, brethren, could not speak to you as to spiritual people, but as to carnal, as to babes in Messiah. I fed you with milk and not with solid food, for until now you were not able to receive it, and even now you are still not able, for you are still carnal. For where there are envy, strife, and divisions among you, are you not carnal and behaving like mere men? For when one says, 'I am of Paul,' and another, 'I am of Apollos,' are you not carnal?" And he goes on to talk about different things there, but the point is this. Paul says that you're only able to handle milk right now. You can't handle meat, and here's why. Because you're still carnal. And the evidence of that carnality is envy, strife, and divisions. So again, Yeshua came that they might be one. And so automatically we understand that the adversary's purpose is going to try to keep them from becoming one. And how do you think he might be great at doing this? By causing envies and strifes and divisions. And so, is it possible that we see within the body at large, but even within the Messianic community, envy, strife, and divisions? What say you? So what is this suggesting? We're still acting like carnal men. We have in the Messianic community those that if you don't pronounce the way, pronounce the name exactly the way I think you should pronounce it, then I'm taking my toys and going home and I'm not playing with you. Right? Because some say it's Yahweh. No, it's Yahweh. No, it's Yehovah. No, it's Yahuwah. You know, or it's Yeshua. No, it's Yahshua. It's Yehoshua. It's Yahuwah. How many of you, when you prayed a prayer to be born again, prayed that other name? Huh? And did he hear you? Yes, he did. So can I just say this? Chill out. Just chill out. Because you know what that is evidence of? We're acting like mere men, Paul says. You're acting carnally. And so right now, there's things that you can't handle. We think, a lot of us, you know, when we begin to learn all of these different things, we thought, boy, this is something else. I know something now. And you don't. We don't know anything, ladies and gentlemen. We aren't nearly ready for all the revelation that the Messiah wants to bring to us. As a matter of fact, if I can borrow from what Paul is saying and couple it with what he says in 1 Corinthians 2, he talks about the wisdom of man and how that comes to nothing. And then he talks about the wisdom of God that was preordained from the ages and for our benefit. And then he talks about the fact that had the princes of this world known, they would have never crucified the Lord of glory. Meaning that the princes of this world, looking in this book, could not glean all the things that God had placed with and embedded within this book. And then he goes on and quotes Isaiah saying, "For as it is written, eye has not seen, ear has not heard, neither has it entered into the hearts of man what God has prepared for those who love him." And when he makes that statement, he's not talking about when we get to heaven. He's talking about the things that are in this book that we need to know and to understand. It hasn't even dawned on us all the things that are contained therein. And while we're acting like mere men and acting carnal and full of envies and strife and divisions, guess what? We're not going to get it. And the reason that this is so important, ladies and gentlemen, is that of those two, it was Elijah he singled out as being the one who's playing such a critical role in this restoration of all things. And I'm telling you that I believe with all of my heart that this group here and others like us are representative of Elijah. And so a great deal of this responsibility is upon our shoulders. And so while that responsibility is there, what are some of us doing? Right? Well, your beard's not long enough. You don't have enough knots in your tzitzit. I don't see your seat, Bill. Well, they're not for you. They're for me. And I don't... That is not to say I have any problem with anybody wearing them outside. I just don't do that. That's just me. But the point is, we're running around trying to figure out what everybody else is not doing. And we're not worried about what we're supposed to be doing. And so, I'm up to here. Can you tell? And here's why. Because there's so many people, ladies and gentlemen, depending on you and me. There's so many people depending on us to come together and to get our act together and make the crooked path straight and prepare the way of the Lord. The onus is on you and me. And the adversary is doing such a good job, as he always does, of exploiting our carnality. That flesh we were talking about last night. So I'll close with this point. Now that I've offended some of you about the tzitzit thing. Oh well. I want us to truly understand the obvious, so that we will truly understand what's not so obvious sometimes. And that if we, and we do, embrace the purpose of our Father, that the two should be one, we need to acknowledge that the objective of the adversary is going to be to do everything in his power to keep that from happening. And so, I'm just going to challenge us all, starting with me, that we begin to be gracious with one another, as brethren should be. And acknowledge the fact that if there's envy and strife, and it's not to say that we can't disagree, we can. But are some of these issues that should cause us to break company with one another and to break fellowship with one another? Or is it possible that maybe that's what somebody else would like to see happen? And so what's more important, me being right or me doing what is right? It says that Yeshua, for the glory that was, or the joy that was set before him, he endured the suffering of the tree. And what is the joy that was set before him? I'll submit to you that the two become one. And for that purpose, that the two should become one, he was willing to lay everything down, everything that he was willing to lay his life down, that the two should become one. And according to what Paul wrote last, that we read about last night in Romans 8, the Spirit bears witness with our spirit that we are the children of God, and if children, then heirs, heirs of God and joint heirs with Messiah. If indeed we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified together. And so my question to you is, as I leave, is how much suffering are we willing to endure for the joy that he wants to bring to fruition? How much are we willing of ourselves to lay down? Is it more important to me to be right than to do what is right? And ladies and gentlemen, I fear that until we get to that place, some of these things, anyway, that we so desire to see are still kind of lingering out there waiting for you and me to get our act together. Can you receive this? So, Father, I pray, as our Messiah prayed, that you would indeed make us one, even as you and Messiah are one. And in praying that, I understand, I believe, that we're about to get our opportunity, because darkness is descending upon the nations and the world. And so, Father, I pray that you would, in each individual, in each family, in each fellowship, and in the body at large, that you would indeed bring us to that place, that we would become one. Let it be according to your plan, according to your purposes, and according to your will. We ask this in the name of Yeshua. And we also ask, Father, that you would, in each individual, in each family, in each fellowship, and in the body at large, that you would continue to expose those things within us, to us, that need to be purged from our lives, so that those that are awaiting out there and dependent somewhat on the choices that we make would be able to see a light in a dark place. Father, may it be your will. In Yeshua's name we pray, amen and amen. God bless you for your time this morning. Thank you for being here.